There was water left in Gerald's glass, but the tip of her makeshift straw would no longer quite touch it. The coverlet beneath the rolled-up blow-in card was dark with moisture. I could get what's left, though, I could. If I could turn my hand a little farther in that unnatural backward direction I needed to get hold of the miserable glass in the first place, I think I can stick my neck a little farther forward to get those last few sips of water. Think I can? I know I can. She did know it, and later on she would test the idea. But for now, the white-collar guys on the top floor, the one with all the good views, had once again wrested control away from the day laborers and shop stewards who ran the machinery. The mutiny was over. Her thirst was a long way from being entirely slaked, but her throat had quit throbbing and she felt a lot better, mentally as well as physically. Sharper in her thoughts and marginally brighter in her outlook. She found she was glad she'd left that last little bit in the glass. Two sips of water through a leaky straw probably wouldn't spell the difference between remaining handcuffed to the bed and finding a way to wiggle out of this mess on her own, let alone between life and death. But getting those last couple of sips might occupy her mind when and if it tried to turn to its own morbid devices again. After all, night was coming. Her husband was lying dead on the floor beside her, and it looked like she was camping out. Not a pretty picture, especially when you added the hungry stray who was camping out with her. But Jessie found she was growing sleepy again just the same. She tried to think of reasons to fight her growing drowsiness and couldn't come up with any good ones. Even the thought of waking up with her arms numb to the elbows didn't seem like a particularly big deal. She would simply move them around until the blood was flowing briskly again. It wouldn't be pleasant, but she had no doubt about her ability to do it. Also, you might have an idea while you're asleep, dear, Goodwife Burlingame said. That always happens in books. Maybe you will, Jessie said. After all, you've had the best one so far. She let herself lie down, using her shoulder blades to scrunch the pillow as far up against the head of the bed as she could. Her shoulders ached. Her arms, especially the left one, throbbed, and her stomach muscles were still fluttering with the strain of holding her upper body far enough forward to drink through the straw. But she felt strangely content just the same, at peace with herself. Content? How can you feel content? Your husband is dead, after all, and you played a part in that, Jessie. And suppose you are found. Suppose you are rescued. Have you thought about how the situation is going to look to whoever finds you? How do you suppose it's going to look to Constable Teagarden, as far as that goes? How long do you think it will take him to decide to call the state police? 30 seconds? Maybe 40? They think a little slower out here in the country, though, don't they? It might take him all of 2 minutes. She couldn't argue with any of that. It was true. Then how can you feel content, Jessie? How can you possibly feel content with things like that hanging over you? She didn't know, but she did. Her sense of tranquility was as deep as a feather bed on the night a March gale filled with sleet roars out of the northwest, and as warm as the goose-down comforter on that bed. She suspected that most of this feeling stemmed from causes which were purely physical. If you were thirsty enough, it was apparently possible to get stoned on half a glass of water. But there was a mental side as well. 10 years ago, she had reluctantly given up her job as a substitute teacher, finally giving in to the pressure of Gerald's persistent, or maybe relentless was the word she was actually looking for, logic. He was making almost $100,000 a year by then. Next to that, her $5,000 to $7,000 looked pretty paltry. It was, in fact, an actual annoyance at tax time, when the IRS took most of it, and then went sniffing over their financial records, wondering where the rest of it was. When she complained about their suspicious behavior, Gerald had looked at her with a mixture of love and exasperation. It wasn't quite his, "Why are you girls so silly?" expression. That one didn't start to show up regularly for another 5 or 6 years, but it was close. "They see what I'm making," he told her. "They see two large German cars in the garage. They look at the pictures of the place and the lake. Then they look at your tax forms and they see you're working for what they think of as chump change. They can't believe it. It looks phony to them, a cover for something. So they go snooping around looking for whatever that something else might be. They don't know you like I do, that's all. She had been unable to explain to Gerald what the substitute contract meant to her. Or maybe it was that he had been unwilling to listen. Either way, it came to the same. Teaching, even on a part-time basis, filled her up in some important way, and Gerald didn't get that. Nor had he been able to get the fact that subbing formed a bridge to the life that she had lived before she'd met Gerald at that Republican mixer, when she'd been a full-time English teacher at Waterville High, a woman on her own who was working for a living, who was well-liked and respected by her colleagues, and who was beholden to no one. She had been unable to explain, or he had been unwilling to listen, how quitting teaching, even on that final part-time piecework basis, made her feel mournful and lost and somehow useless. That rudderless feeling, probably caused as much by her inability to catch pregnant as by her decision to return her contract unsigned, had departed from the surface of her mind after a year or so, but it had never entirely left the deeper ranges of her heart. She had sometimes felt like a cliché to herself. Young teacher lady weds successful lawyer, whose name goes up on the door at the tender, professionally speaking, that is, age of 30. This young, well, relatively young woman eventually steps into the foyer of that puzzle palace known as middle age, looks around, and finds she is suddenly all alone, no job, no kids, and a husband who is almost completely focused. One wouldn't want to say fixated, that might be accurate, but it would also be unkind, on climbing that fabled ladder of success. This woman, suddenly faced with 40 just beyond the next bend in the road, is exactly the sort of woman most likely to get in trouble with drugs, booze, or another man. A younger man, usually. None of that happened to this young, well, previously young woman. But Jessie still found herself with a scary amount of time on her hands. Time to garden, time to go mauling, time to take classes, the painting, the sculpture, the poetry. And she could have had an affair with a man who taught the poetry if she wanted to, and she had almost wanted to. There had also been time to do a little work on herself, which was how she had happened to meet Nora. Yet not one of those things had left her feeling the way she felt now, as though her weariness and aches were badges of valor, and her sleepiness a justly won reward. The handcuffed lady's version of Miller time, you might say.
Hey, Jess, the way you got that water was pretty great.
It was another UFO, but this time Jessie didn't mind. Just as long as Ruth didn't show up for a while. Ruth was interesting, but she was also exhausting.
A lot of people would never have even gotten the glass,
her UFO fan continued.
And using the blow-in card for a straw, that was a masterstroke. So go ahead and feel good. It's allowed. A little nap is allowed, too.
But the dog, Goody said doubtfully.
That dog isn't going to bother you one damned bit. And you know why.
Yes. The reason the dog wasn't going to bother her was lying nearby on the bedroom floor. Gerald was now nothing but a shadow among shadows, for which Jessie was grateful. Outside, the wind gusted again. The sound of it hissing through the pines was comforting, lulling. Jessie closed her eyes.
But be careful what you dream, Goody called after her in sudden alarm.
But her voice was distant and not terribly compelling. Still, it tried again.
Be careful what you dream, Jessie. I'm serious.
Yes, of course she was. The good wife was always serious, which meant she was also often tiresome. Whatever I dream, Jessie thought, it won't be that I'm thirsty. I haven't had many clear victories over the last 10 years, mostly one murky guerrilla engagement after another. But getting that drink of water was a clear win, wasn't it?
Yes,
the UFO voice agreed. It was a vaguely masculine voice, and she found herself wondering in a sleepy way if perhaps it was the voice of her brother Will as he'd been as a child, back in the 60s.
You bet it was. It was great.
5 minutes later, Jesse was sleeping deeply, arms up and splayed in a limp V-shape, wrists held loosely to the bedpost by the handcuffs, head lolling against her right shoulder, the less painful one, long, slow snores drifting from her mouth. And at some point, long after dark had fallen and a white rind of moon had risen in the east, the dog appeared in the doorway again. Like Jesse, it was calmer now that its most immediate need had been met, and the clamor in its stomach had been stilled to some extent. It gazed at her raptly for a long time, with its good ear cocked and its muzzle up, trying to decide if she was really asleep or only pretending. It decided, mostly on the basis of smell, the sweat which was now drying, the total absence of the crackling ozone stink of adrenaline, that she was asleep. There would be no kicks or shouts this time, not if it was careful not to wake her up. The dog padded softly to the heap of meat in the middle of the floor. Although its hunger was now less, the meat actually smelled better. This was because its first meal had gone a long way toward breaking down the ancient, inbred taboo against this sort of meat, although the dog did not know this and wouldn't have cared if it did. It lowered its head, first sniffing the now attractive aroma of the dead lawyer with all the delicacy of a gourmet. Then closing its teeth gently on Gerald's lower lip, it pulled, applying pressure slowly, stretching the flesh further and further. Gerald began to look as if he were deep in some monstrous pout. The lip finally tore off, revealing his bottom teeth in a big dead grin. The dog swallowed the small delicacy in a single gulp, then licked its chops. Its tail began to wag again, this time moving in slow, contented sweeps. Two tiny spots of light danced on the ceiling high above, moonlight reflected from the fillings in two of Gerald's lower molars. These fillings had been done only the week before, and they were still as fresh and shiny as newly minted quarters. The dog licked its chops a second time, looking lovingly at Gerald as it did so. Then it stretched its neck forward, almost exactly as Jessie had stretched hers in order to finally plop her straw into the glass. The dog sniffed Gerald's face. But it did not just sniff. It allowed its nose to go on a kind of olfactory vacation there, first sampling the faint floor-polishy aroma of brown wax buried deep in the dead master's left ear, then the intermingled odors of sweat and prell at the hairline, then the sharp, entrancingly bitter smell of clotted blood on the crown of Gerald's head. It lingered especially long at Gerald's nose, conducting a delicate investigation into those now tideless channels with its scratched, dirty, but oh-so-sensitive muzzle. Again, there was that sense of gourmandizing, a feeling that the dog was choosing among many unexpected treasures. At last it sank its sharp teeth deeply into Gerald's left cheek, clamped them together, and began to pull. On the bed, Jessie's eyes had begun to move rapidly back and forth behind her lids, and now she moaned, a high, wavering sound full of terror and recognition. The dog looked up once, its body dropping into an instinctive cringe of guilt and fear. It didn't last long. Already it had begun to see this pile of meat not as something forbidden, approachable only in the toils of hunger and approaching starvation, but as its private larder, for which it would fight, and perhaps die if challenged. Besides, it was only the bitchmaster making that sound, and the dog was now quite sure that the bitchmaster was powerless. It dipped its head down, seized Gerald Burlingame's cheek once more, and yanked backwards, shaking its head briskly from side to side as it did so. A long strip of the dead man's cheek came free with a sound like strapping tape being pulled briskly off the dispenser roll. Gerald now wore the ferocious, predatory smile of a man who has just filled a straight flush in a high-stakes poker game. Jesse moaned again. The sound was followed by a string of guttural, unintelligible sleep talk. The dog glanced up at her once more. It was sure she couldn't get off the bed and bother it, but those sounds made it uneasy just the same. The old taboo had faded, but it hadn't disappeared. Besides, its hunger was sated, What it was doing now wasn't eating, but snacking. It turned and trotted out of the room again. Most of Gerald's left cheek dangled from its mouth like the scalp of an infant. It is August 14th, 1965. A little over 2 years since the day the sun went out. It is Will's birthday. He has gone around all day solemnly telling people that he has now lived a year for each inning in a baseball game. Jesse is unable to understand why this seems like a big deal to her brother, but it clearly does, and she decides that if Will wants to compare his life to a baseball game, that's perfectly okay. For quite a while, everything that happens at her little brother's birthday party is perfectly okay. Marvin Gaye is on the record player, true, but it is not the bad song, the dangerous song. "I wouldn't be doggone," Marvin sings, mock-threatening. "I be long gone, baby." Actually sort of a cute song, and the truth is that the day has been a lot better than okay, at least so far. It has been, in the words of Jesse's great-aunt Catherine, finer than fiddle music. Even her dad thinks so, although he wasn't very keen on the idea of coming back to Falmouth for Will's birthday when the idea was first suggested. Jesse had heard him say, "I guess it was a pretty good idea after all," to her mom, and that makes her feel good, because it was she, Jesse Mayhoot, daughter of Tom and Sally, sister of Will and Maddie, wife of nobody, who put the idea over. She's the reason they're here instead of inland at Sunset Trails. Sunset Trails is the family camp, although after three generations of haphazard family expansion, it is really big enough to be called a compound, on the north end of Darkscore Lake. This year they have broken their customary 9 weeks of seclusion there, because Will wants, just once, he has told his mother and father, speaking in the tones of a nobly suffering old grandee who knows he cannot cheat the reaper much longer, to have a birthday party with his rest-of-the-year friends as well as his family. Tom Mayhoot vetoes the idea at first. He is a stockbroker who divides his time between Portland and Boston, and for years he's told his family not to believe all that propaganda about how guys who go to work wearing ties and shirts with white collars spend their days goofing off, either hanging around the water cooler or dictating lunch invitations to pretty blondes from the Steno pool. "No hard scrapple spud farmer in Aroostook County works any harder than I do," he frequently tells them. "Keeping up with the market isn't easy, and it isn't particularly glamorous either, no matter what you may have heard to the contrary." The truth is, none of them have heard anything to the contrary. All of them, his wife included, most likely, although Sally would never say so, think his job sounds duller than donkey shit, and only Maddie has the vaguest idea of what it is he does. Tom insists that he needs that time on the lake to recover from the stresses of his job, and that his son will have plenty of birthdays with his friends later on. Will is turning 9, after all, not 90. "Plus," Tom adds, "birthday parties with your pals really aren't much fun until you're old enough to have a keg or two." So Will's request to have his birthday at the family's year-round home on the coast would probably have been denied if not for Jesse's sudden, surprising support of the plan. And to Will, it's plenty surprising. Jesse is 3 years older, and lots of times he's not sure she remembers she even has a brother. Following her initial soft-voiced suggestion that maybe it would be fun to come home, just for 2 or 3 days, of course, and have a lawn party with croquet and badminton and a barbecue and Japanese lanterns that would come on at dusk, Tom begins to warm to the idea. He is the sort of man who thinks of himself as a strong-willed son of a bitch, and is often thought of as a stubborn old goat by others. Whichever way you saw it, he has always been a tough man to move once he has set his feet and his jaw. His younger daughter is an exception to the general rule. Jessie has often found a way into her father's mind by some loophole or secret passage denied to the rest of the family. Sally believes it's just that their middle child is Tom's favorite, and Tom has fooled himself into believing that none of the others know. Maddie and Will see it in simpler terms. They believe that Jesse sucks up to their father, and that he in turn spoils her rotten. "If Daddy caught Jesse smoking," Will told his older sister the year before, after Maddie had been grounded for that very offense. He'd probably buy her a lighter. Maddie laughed, agreed, and hugged her brother. Neither they nor her mother would have the slightest idea of the secret which lies between Tom Mayhoot and his younger daughter, like a heap of rotting meat. Jessie herself believes she is just going along with her baby brother's request, that she's sticking up for him. She has no idea, not on the surface of her mind anyway, how much she has come to hate Sunset Trails and how eager she is to get away. She has also come to hate the lake she once passionately loved, especially its faint, flat, mineral smell. By 1965, she can hardly bear to go swimming there, even on the hottest of days. She knows her mother thinks it's her shape. Jessie began to bud early, as Sally did herself, and at the age of 12, she has most of her woman's figure. But it's not her shape. She's gotten used to that, and knows that she's a long way from being a Playboy pinup in either of her old, faded Janssen tank suits. No, it's not her breasts, not her hips, not her can. It's that smell. Whatever reasons and motives may be swirling around beneath, Will Mayhoot's request is finally approved by the Mayhoot family's head honcho. They made the trip back to the coast yesterday, leaving early enough for Sally, eagerly assisted by both daughters, to prepare for the party. And now it's August 14th, and August 14th is surely the apotheosis of summer in Maine, a day of faded blue denim skies and fat white clouds, all of it freshened by a salt-tangy breeze. Inland, and that includes the Lakes District, where Sunset Trails has stood on the shore of Dark Score Lake since Tom Mayhoot's grandfather built the original cabin in 1923. The woods and lakes and ponds and bogs lie sweltering under temperatures in the mid-90s, and humidity just below the saturation point. But here on the seacoast, it's only 80. The sea breeze is an extra bonus, rendering the humidity negligible and sweeping away the mosquitoes and the sandflies. The lawn is filled with children, mostly Will's friends, but girls who chum with Maddie and Jessie as well. And for once, mirabile dictu, they all seem to be getting along. There hasn't been a single argument, and around 5 o'clock, as Tom raises the first martini of the day to his lips, he glances at Jessie, who is standing nearby with her croquet mallet propped on her shoulder like a sentry's rifle, and who is clearly within earshot of what sounds like a casual husband and wife conversation, but which may actually be a shrewd bank-shot compliment aimed at his daughter, then back at his wife. "I guess it was actually a pretty good idea, after all," he says. "Better than good," Jessie thinks. "Absolutely great and totally monster, if you want to know the truth." Even that isn't what she really means, really thinks, but it would be dangerous to say the rest out loud. It would tempt the gods. What she really thinks is that the day is flawless, a sweet and perfect peach of a day. Even the song blasting out of Maddie's portable record player, which Jessie's big sister has cheerfully carted out to the patio for this occasion, although it is ordinarily the great untouchable icon, is okay. Jessie is never really going to like Marvin Gaye, no more than she is ever going to like that faint mineral smell which rises from the lake on hot summer afternoons. But this song is okay. "I'll be doggone if you ain't a pretty thing, baby." Silly, but not dangerous. It is August 14th, 1965, a day that was, a day that still is, in the mind of a dreaming woman handcuffed to a bed, in a house on the shore of a lake 40 miles south of Dark Score, but with the same mineral smell, that nasty evocative smell, on hot, still summer days. And although the 12-year-old girl she was doesn't see Will creeping up behind her as she bends over to address her croquet ball, turning her bottom into a target simply too tempting for a boy who's only lived 1 year for each inning in a baseball game to ignore, part of her mind knows he is there, and that this is the seam where the dream has been basted to the nightmare. She lines up her shot, concentrating on the wicket 6 feet away. A hard shot, but not an impossible one. And if she drives the ball through, she may well catch Carolyn after all. That would be nice, because Carolyn almost always wins at croquet. Then just as she draws her mallet back, the music coming from the record player changes. "Oh, listen, everybody," Marvin Gaye sings, sounding a lot more than just mock-threatening to Jesse this time. "Especially you girls." Chills of goose flesh run up Jesse's tanned arms. "Is it right to be left alone when the one you love is never home? I love too hard," my friends sometimes say. Her fingers go numb, and she loses any sense of the mallet in her hands. Her wrists are tingling, as if bound by...
Stocks. Goody's in the stocks. Come and see Goody in the stocks. Come and laugh at Goody in the stocks.
Unseen clamps, and her heart is suddenly full of dismay. It is the other song. The wrong song, the bad song. But I believe, that a woman should be loved this way. She looks up at the little group of girls waiting for her to make her shot, and sees that Carolyn is gone. Standing there in her place is Nora Callaghan. Her hair is in braids. There's a dab of white zinc on the tip of her nose. She's wearing Carolyn's yellow sneakers and Carolyn's locket, the one with a tiny picture of Paul McCartney inside it. But those are Nora's green eyes, and they are looking at her with a deep, adult compassion. Jesse suddenly remembers that Will, undoubtedly egged on by his buddies, who are as jazzed up on Cokes and German chocolate cake as Will himself, is creeping up behind her, that he's preparing to goose her. She will overreact wildly when he does, swinging around and punching him in the mouth, perhaps not spoiling the party completely, but certainly putting a ding in its sweet perfection. She tries to let go of the mallet, wanting to straighten and turn around before any of this can happen. She wants to change the past, but the past is heavy. Trying to do that, she discovers, is like trying to pick up the house by one corner so you can look under it for things that have been lost, or forgotten, or hidden. Behind her, someone has cranked the volume on Maddie's little record player, and that terrible song blares louder than ever, triumphant and glittery and sadistic. "It hurts me so inside, to be treated so unkind. Somebody, somewhere, tell her it ain't fair." She tries again to get rid of the mallet, to throw it away, but she can't do it. It's as if someone has handcuffed her to it. "Nora," she cries. "Nora, you have to help me. Stop him!" It was at this point in the dream that Jesse moaned for the first time, momentarily startling the dog back from Gerald's body. Nora shakes her head slowly and gravely. "I can't help you, Jesse. You're on your own. We all are. I generally don't tell my patients that, but I think in your case it's best to be honest."
"You don't understand. I can't go through this again. I can't!"
"Oh, don't be so silly," Nora says, suddenly impatient. She begins to turn away, as if she can no longer bear the sight of Jesse's upturned, frantic face. "You will not die. It's not poison." Jesse looks around wildly, although she remains unable to straighten up, to stop presenting that tempting target to her impending brother, and sees that her friend Tammy Ho is gone. Standing there in Tammy's white shorts and yellow halter is Ruth Neary. She's holding Tammy's red-striped croquet mallet in one hand and a Marlboro in the other. Her mouth is hooked up at the corners in her usual sardonic grin, but her eyes are grave and full of sorrow.
"Ruth, help me!" Jesse shouts. "You have to help me!"